In this episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, one woman tries to save what doesn't need saving, only to almost need to be saved herself.
And I turn around just in time to see the line on the dinghy unravel and go, whoop! Oh, that's ironic. So now, I mean, this is bad because there goes my ride to shore.
And a man nearly burns down Fairbanks in an effort to have a prettier lawn than his neighbors.
And the flames were no longer little flames in the lawn. They were flames shooting 6 to 8 to 10 feet high, no lie, crackling and blowing in the wind.
Best Intentions, up next on Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. I'm Rob Prince. Isn't it kind of a weird feeling when you swoop into a situation in an effort to make it better and you only just make it much, much worse? It sort of leaves a kind of a funny taste in your mouth. One time my friend tried to help me pull my truck out of the snow, and instead he drug it through a bush and ripped the rearview mirror off, which I can laugh about now. Well, if you know what it feels like to make a situation much worse, despite your best intentions, you are not alone. In today's episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, we have two stories of people trying to save the day, only to nearly flush it all down the toilet. Up first is Katie Ott, a graduate of the first Dark Winter Nights storytelling workshop. She is now a member of the Dark Winter Nights team. She shared this story at our April 2016 live event in Herring Auditorium. Here's Katie Ott.
So this story takes place in the summer of 2006 in Prince William Sound. If you guys are familiar with that area, it's just a beautiful coastal rainforest. We were on a remote island in Prince William Sound. We were on Night Island. It's about 3.5 hours by small boat in good weather from Whittier. We were out there for 3.5 months, so we were there for a long time. And because we were there for so long, we had a pretty substantial field camp. We had multiple tent platforms. We had a weather port for cooking and drying our gear. We had a fuel cache, and we installed a really robust mooring for our boat. And the boat that we used while we were out there for day-to-day work is a little 17-foot Boston Whaler, and these are just perfectly suited boats for doing field work in the Sound. They're just really reliable. They float really well. The boat that we had this year was brand new. It was top of the line, right off the assembly line, and we were able to afford this boat because my advisor was particularly good at writing grants, and she wrote a grant specifically for this vessel, and so it represented a significant chunk of our budget for our research. And it was also really important to her sentimentally because it was named after her dearly departed dog, Gaia, who had passed away the year before. So Gaia had spent several field seasons in the Sound with my advisor, and naming the boat after her dog was another way of kind of keeping the dog close, and it was always a reminder that she's still out there with us. So we had about half a dozen people in camp with us at any given time, but there were several of us that were there for the whole field season. So we had my advisor, myself, her dog, and then another graduate student who was studying botany. And for this story, I'm going to call him Murphy. And that's an appropriate name because he was incredibly accident prone. I'm not saying that to be mean or to poke fun at him. He's now an accomplished professional. He has a career. But even he would admit that he was just super accident prone. Anything he got involved in kind of went south in a hurry. So just a couple examples. One day he was entering data in his field notebook, and he was walking along in the forest and he walked off a 15-foot cliff. That's kind of a big deal because we're a long way from medical attention. So luckily that day he walked away with just a sprained ankle, but it could have been a lot worse. Another day, we were on site, and he was crashing through some understory, and he was holding these branches back, and they slipped, and they whipped back and hit him in the face, and it actually tore his cornea, it was incredibly painful. He had to be medevaced to Anchorage for that one, and then he had the honor of wearing an eye patch for more than a month, so he recovered from that as well. So he was accident prone. But he tried really hard. And there were a few things in camp that he kind of struggled with, like starting the fuel stove in the cook tent, or gathering fresh water for drinking, or tying up the boats. So when we got to the camp, we had to learn how to tie up the boat to the mooring. And to do this, we would use a bowline knot, and we all had to learn how to tie this knot and demonstrate it, that we could do it proficiently for our advisor before she would let us tie up the boat. And the bowline knot is fantastic. If you've never used one before, it's easy to tie, it's easy to untie, even after you've put a lot of tension on it. So it was the knot that we used by rote to tie up our boat. For whatever reason, Murphy just couldn't figure out the bowline. Our advisor taught him, we kind of coached him. You could actually sit with him and guide his hands through the motions, and he could do it, and then you'd step away and say, okay, your turn, and his knot would fall apart. And it was kind of frustrating for him, but it didn't really matter because the rest of us could step in and kind of do it for him, and we knew that he was trying really hard. That was obvious, so it wasn't a big deal. So, this being Alaska, we're used to all kinds of weather, and occasionally we would have weather days, small craft advisories, where we wouldn't be able to go to work. We'd be stuck in camp, you know, we'd just stay in the cook tent all day. But there was one storm in particular that was really memorable, and this was a gale warning. And those are fairly uncommon inside the Sound because it's pretty protected. But we knew that the storm was coming. We'd been listening to the marine radio, and it was forecast to hit overnight and then continue for a day or so beyond that. And so as we're coming back to camp this day, we knew there's like all this stuff we got to take care of to kind of batten down the hatches for the storm. So we hit the beach and we just scatter. And, you know, one person's grabbing gear and storing it under the weather port. Another person's taking stuff off of lines and putting it away safe. And we all just have these chores that we got to get done. But we finish that up and we kind of, you know, relax, go back to the cook tent and have a nice hot meal. And the storm's starting to pick up. And we just, you know, visited in the cook tent, told stories, played cards, ate snack food. We knew we didn't have to go to work the next day because it was going to be a really bad weather day. So we just, we stayed up pretty late, and it was probably 1:30 before we turned in. And as we were heading off to our tents, we checked out, looked at the beach, and, you know, squinted into the rain and the waves, and you could see the Gaia was riding high. She was still out there, so that's good. So then we headed up to bed, and I crawled into my sleeping bag, and I was just kind of, you know, settling down for the night. And, you know, listening to the waves crashing on the beach. It's like, is that something hitting the beach? Nah, it's fine. Like, I hope the boat's okay. Who tied up the boat today? It was Murphy. Murphy tied up the boat today. And I don't know how it escaped our collective memory or our collective attention that when we all got back to camp, we had these tasks that we were fixated on accomplishing. And so when he volunteered to tie up the boat, nobody raised a red flag. And so I'm thinking like, oh God, what do I do? Well, it's probably fine because, you know, she was still on the mooring when we went to bed. So she's not going anywhere. So I was like, just try to go to sleep. It's fine. Just sleep. The more I could hear the waves crashing and imagining the sounds of things hitting the beach and imagining the boat getting wrecked. And then, of course, I thought, you know, in the morning, if the Gaia is either gone or wrecked against the beach, I'm not going to be able to look my advisor in the eye and say, oh, I definitely didn't realize that there was a potential huge problem and I did nothing about it. So I begrudgingly realized that the only way I'm going to get any sleep is if I go check that knot. So I haul myself out of bed, and I put on my clammy rain gear and my extra tufts, and I trudge down the trail to the beach, and I grab my PFD along the way. And I get out there, and the guy is still there. It's good. And the tide is also really high, so that's good. That means I don't have to drag the dinghy too far to get to the water. So in order to get out to the Gaia, we would use this little inflatable dinghy. It's like a one-person inner tube with a floor and oarlocks. And you would just use it to ferry yourself from shore to the Gaia. So it took a while for me to launch into the waves and the wind. It was kind of a bear, but I eventually got away from shore and started heading out toward the Gaia. And I got out there and I crawled over the rail, and I knew I'm only gonna be there for like 30 seconds tops because I'm just gonna check this knot. So I real quick tied up the dinghy with a half hitch and I ran to the front of the bow and I pulled up that bow line and I fixed my headlamp on that knot. And it's perfect. There's nothing wrong with that knot. It is textbook. I don't know how he did it, but he did. And so I'm kind of incredulous for a minute, like, cool, okay. So I drop the knot, and I turn around just in time to see the line on the dinghy unravel and go, whoop. Like, oh, that's ironic. So now, I mean, this is bad because there goes my ride to shore. And it sounds funny, but it's I don't have a whole lot of options here. I could swim for it, but that'd be really stupid because it's the middle of a gale and it's dark and nobody knows I'm out here. I could wait overnight for somebody to get the dinghy and bring it back to me, or I could try to catch the dinghy with the Gaia. So that's really my only option. And I've got to do it in a very short time period because I've described this beach, but it's not the kind of sandy, soft beach. This is a rocky, bouldery beach. So any boat that gets pushed against this beach is going to be destroyed in short order. So I don't have a whole lot of time to catch the dinghy before it gets back to the beach. It gets into shallow water where I can't follow it. So I run to the center console of the boat, and these whalers are built so you stand up and steer from the center. And when you turn the ignition switch, it makes this like high-pitched beep. So it starts right up, and I run to the front, and I untie that perfect bowline knot. And then I run back to the console, and I throw it in gear and whip around and start the most intense medium-speed chase you've ever seen. Because I don't have a whole lot of freeboard. I know, and the waves are kind of throwing off my mental map of what the shore looks like and how much draft I actually have, but I know it's not much. And so I'm chasing after this dinghy, and I don't want my momentum to carry me beyond where I can actually stop. And I know I'm getting shallow, and I'm anticipating any moment I'm going to feel the hull ground out. And so I raise the prop about halfway because that's what's in the water the deepest. I don't want to bust the prop, but when I do that, it means I also don't have as much power or maneuverability. So the prop is half raised, and I'm slowly chasing after the dinghy, and I know I'm going to wreck this boat. And then eventually I somehow catch up to the dinghy, and I just bump it with the nose of the Gaia. And so I run to the front, I grab the line on the dinghy, and I head back to the console. And now my only option is to back straight up the way that I came in, because if I were to try to do a U-turn, I would be broadside to the waves, and that would immediately push me against the beach. It'd be over in a heartbeat. So my only option is to just back straight up. And so now I'm backing straight into the waves. I don't have as much power from my half-raised prop, and so it's an extremely slow process. And the waves, now that I'm backing straight into them, are coming over the transom and filling the boat with seawater. But it's working. It's working. I eventually get back into deeper water, and I'm able to lower the prop and then turn around and head back out toward the buoy. And I'm tying up, and I realize I'd probably better spend a little bit of time bilging all this seawater out, because there's probably about a foot of water in the hull of the Gaia now, and that's a lot. So I'm bilging, and I'm just kind of, you know, breathing a sigh of relief and thinking, thank God, nobody got hurt, I didn't destroy our boat, and nobody knows. So I jump back in the dinghy when I finish that chore, and I'm, you know, just thankfully rowing back to shore. And I look over my shoulder, and there's somebody standing on the beach. Like, huh, somebody got up after all. So, and I can kind of tell from their posture that they are not happy. And so I hit the shore, and it's my advisor. She is displeased. Understandably so. So it turns out that when I started the engine and the ignition went beep, her dog heard that and alerted her that something was wrong. She thought maybe there was a bear in camp, but it turns out her grad student was taking the boat for a joyride in the middle of a gale in the shallow end. So she came out at 2 a.m. in her rain gear to see this entire circus unfold. She had a lot of questions for me. Yeah, you know, she was upset, and understandably so, because number one, she is the primary investigator on this study. She's responsible for everybody's safety, and I definitely should have told somebody what I was doing. Number two, She's responsible for an incredibly complex budget and logistical plan, and the crux of that plan is this boat. And if this boat is not operational, then we've wasted tons of money and lots of people's time. So if something were to happen, it would have been really bad. So to this day, Murphy doesn't know that I doubted him that much, and I would be really embarrassed if he found out. I learned a few things. The first is obviously, no matter what, always use the appropriate knot for the right situation. And second, maybe don't be so quick to write somebody off when they make a mistake or two, because they just might come back to surprise you, like Murphy did. So that's my story. Thanks for listening.
That was Katie Ott, graduate of the 2016 Dark Winter Nights Storytelling Workshop. By the way, if you'd like to be part of the next Dark Winter Nights True Stories from Alaska Storytelling class, we'll be offering the course again in early 2018 through the Folk School Fairbanks. Like Dark Winter Nights on Facebook or visit us at darkwinternights.com for updates. Sound recording on that story was by John Huff of Alaska Universal Productions. This is Dark Winter Nights True Stories from Alaska. Today's episode is Best Intentions. I'm Rob Prince. Our next story comes from our January 2015 Dark Winter Nights Light event. It was light in the sense that it was a small event, not that it was actually light out. It was actually very, very dark, but Dark Winter Nights Dark just sounds redundant. I think it's safe to say that Ken Moore is a little obsessed with his lawn. He's originally from the lower 48, so we can assume he brought that obsession up with him. On the first warm day of spring in 2011, he decided it would be a good idea to mow his lawn. Really short. He had reasons for that, but it doesn't matter. What you need to know is that it was an exceptionally dry spring, and Fairbanks was a tinderbox. And it was windy. Here's Ken Moore.
I began in the front lawn, and I mowed the front lawn. Now, every two or three swaths across the lawn, I had to empty the bag of thatch. So I decided to empty the bag of thatch into a pile in my backyard.
Before we get too far into this story, let me set the scene for you a little bit. Ken lives in the Riverview neighborhood on the Chena River in Fairbanks. The river is about 50 feet wide by his house, and he has about 150 feet of riverfront. Along the bank of the river is a few feet of dry reeds and natural growth that's meant to prevent erosion. And then there's about 20 feet of meticulously maintained dry lawn, which leads up to his ample dry deck that's about a foot off the ground. To say that his house was situated on a really nice piece of kindling would not be an exaggeration on this particular day.
I decided to stack the clippings, or pile them, the mulch, the old grass, down by the river. And oh, by the way, if I'm looking at the river from the back of my house, right over here at the edge of my lawn where I'm stacking the clippings is a trophy spruce tree. It's gorgeously shaped. It's been growing for decades. And it's just across the line into my neighbor's lawn. It's a centerpiece of his landscaping, and it is undoubtedly one of the centerpieces of our view. And so I stacked the mulch and I finished the front yard. I came around and I mowed around the side yard, and I began mowing in the backyard. And so I was going up and down, river up to the house, 30 feet long, back and forth. About halfway through mowing the back lawn, stopping, of course, very frequently to empty. Did I tell you that pile of dry grass was quaking in the wind? It was probably almost as tall as me, and it was huge. And it was stacked right close to that nice spruce tree. And I got about halfway done, and I ran out of gas. And so I went to the garage over here through the open door, and I got the gas can, filled the lawnmower with gas, and proceeded to set the gas can on the lawn right over in front of the open garage door into my garage. Well, I started up the mower again, and I took two or three more swaths, and I turned around at the house, and I started back down toward the river, and something startled me suddenly. Because right there, about 10 or 15 feet from me, where I had just mowed, were some flames. And little flames, growing into bigger flames. Now, it's probably a little black circle of fire about a foot in diameter. And I thought, no big deal. I dropped the lawnmower handle and it shut off. And I went over and I began stomping with my boots the fire. After about two stomps, I realized it was totally the wrong thing to do, because every time I stomped the fire, it was so dry that the fire just spit over and spread into a much larger fire. And I realized, this is not working well at all. I screamed to my wife, who was in the house, and I said, "Come here, grab some buckets!" And she went through the garage and grabbed some buckets. She had the presence of mind to see someone walking by on Riverview Drive at the front of our house, a young gentleman. She screamed at him to come and help us. So three of us, while this fire was beginning to spread very quickly. Now, the wind was blowing a lot, but it was not blowing strictly in one direction, because the river acts as a wind tunnel, at least it did on this day. And when it comes down the river, it just swirls. And so the fire was simultaneously beginning here and going all directions more quickly than you can imagine. And you wonder, how can a lawn burn so prolifically? Let me tell you, it's the same concept as a forest fire. When the wind is blowing and the forest fire gets really hot and it tops the trees and it just starts going along the top of the trees, well, I'll tell you what, even dry grass this long and dry grass that I haven't yet mowed, it does exactly the same thing. It just started moving faster than you can imagine. So we grabbed the buckets and we were dipping water out of the river and throwing water on the fire and realizing we're absolutely losing this game.
The fire was spreading in all directions like the ripples from a stone dropped into a pond. Toward the river, toward the 6-foot-tall thatch pile underneath his neighbor's precious tree, and toward the neatly aligned kindling that Ken called a deck. In just moments, the fire had gone completely out of control.
I had my cell phone in my pocket. I called 911. As soon as I hung up from the dispatcher, I heard the sirens. By this time, the fire had gone into the wild area along the river, and the flames were no longer little flames in the lawn. They were flames shooting 6 to 8 to 10 feet high, no lie, crackling and blowing in the wind. Fire department showed up. It felt like a half hour. They showed up within minutes as quickly as they could, came screaming down Riverview Drive, stopped, and began to extinguish the fire. Now, by this time, the fire had reached the thatch pile, and it was burning prolifically. They put out the fire, and they were very, very kind and very generous. And they finished and put away their hoses. And we were standing there going, wow, this was really, really close. The fire had literally come a couple of feet from the gas can. It had come right up to the deck. When they sprayed it, it was beginning to move under the deck.
With the fire now extinguished, there was just one last thing to sort out. What to do with the massive 6-foot-tall smoldering pile of thatch? Do you rake it all apart and risk restarting the fire? Do you just leave it there to smolder? In a stroke of genius, one firefighter suggested they just shove the whole thing into the river, where it would, they presumed, harmlessly sink and put itself out. Problem solved. So they shoved it into the Chena River, that runs right through the middle of Fairbanks, and drove away as the smoldering pile bobbed its way along like a huge, hairy, jolly man tubing down the Chena while smoking a cigar and taking in the beauty of the incredibly dry, brushy banks of the river. Okay, maybe not my best analogy, but you get the idea.
Now, as they went down the street, down Riverview one direction, here came a yellow forestry truck, you know, the kind that they have the firefighting equipment on the back, from the other direction. And this officer drove up. He got out of his car with a lot of determination. And you see, the forestry department had been sitting up on the steep. Those of you who aren't from Fairbanks, it's up on the north side of town, big steep hill. And when you if you sit up on top of the steep, you overlook the whole valley. The forestry department was literally sitting up there that day watching for smoke or for fire anywhere in the valley that was not supposed to be there. They had seen that fire, they had seen the smoke, and had just enough time to arrive right after the fire department had left. The officer got out of his vehicle, stomped around my house. He already had his citation book out, you know, the book that they write the tickets on. He had it out. As he walked across the back lawn, he said, "Sir, did you not know that there is a burning ban today?" "Yes, sir, I know there's a burning ban." He said, "And you have broken the burning ban." I said, "Sir, wait, I have to tell you how this began." I told him, "Sir, I was mowing my lawn and the lawnmower started the fire." He looked at me as though I was from both Venus and Mars simultaneously. Like, right. I said, "Sir, no, come and look." So I took him over to the lawnmower that was sitting over here, all nice and shiny on the top. But as I moved it and tipped it up under the deck of the lawnmower, started a little fire. And he backed up and he put his book into his pocket and decided that maybe I wasn't the outlaw that he thought I was. We looked around and he too was musing at how in the world did this whole place just not go up in flames.
After the officer realized this nut wasn't intentionally starting fires today, Ken began to regale him with the blow-by-blow details of the inferno, including the part about the fire department shoving the smoking pile of thatch into the river. "They did what?" he yelled. Well, I imagine it was more masculine than that, but at any rate, he immediately radioed his team to tell them to get a boat in the water ASAP.
And they told him where to go in, way downriver, and said, "Get it in there as soon as you blankety-blank can and come up the river in your boat and look for smoldering, flaming bogs of grass on the river," which they did. So the other trucks left. He stayed there and decided to stay until the boat actually came and pulled up on the shore quite a few minutes later. And they assured their partner that they had, in fact, extinguished, broken up all of the flaming, smoldering bogs. Well, I gained a new friend that day, and I realized also how well the folks in our community serve their citizens to keep us out of danger. There's been a lot of serious news in the last few months on the legalization of marijuana, and now we as the great outstanding citizens of Alaska have voted for the legalization of such. But at the end of the day, especially the end of May 14th, 2011, I decided that smoking weed and grass is not such a great idea after all.
Ken Moore. He shared that story at our January 2015 Dark Winter Nights live event in Fairbanks. Thanks for listening to this episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. Today's episode was edited by myself, Rob Prince, story consultation by Lori Neufeld. So you haven't forgot that we really need your true stories from Alaska, right? I'll just assume you're waiting to find the time to send those stories through the darkwinternights.com website. I bet you're going to get around to doing that right now, right? In the meantime, we're working to put together another big live show in Fairbanks' Herring Auditorium this spring. Keep an eye on our website or like us on Facebook for updates. Dark Winter Nights is produced with support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Communication and Journalism Department, UAF Kojo. Tell great stories. Remember, these are the stories we tell up here in Alaska on Dark Winter Nights. I'm Rob Prince.